It's summer. The heat's on Mayor Rahm Emanuel. The heat is so intense that his tiny feet are sweating in those tiny little loafers. Protesters on the streets, protesters outside his home, protesters even running him out from a coffee with Democratic gubernatorial candidate J.B. Pritzker on East 43rd Street. They're angry, and they're just gearing up. So what does Rahm do in response? He shows up at a friendly economic club lunch to talk about his softer side, talk about his feelings and the pain in his soul, his emotions. This is the 2018 version of his soft, fuzzy sweater commercial. And he barely won re-election in 2015 after spending tens of millions of dollars. And that was when City Hall was sitting on that Laquan McDonald video. The mayor wants to campaign for re-election at 30,000 feet. He's going to fly on that jet stream of that $10 million in campaign money he's already raised and the breath of his corporate friends. And he'll use it to get to the runoff election matchup that suits him best. The other candidates want to bring him down to earth. That's the conflict for now. And today we're going to talk to Paul Vallis, the one candidate Rahm Emanuel desperately does not want to face in a runoff. You're going to hear from other candidates on this podcast. They all bring something. They're all interesting. And they all have good ideas and bad ideas. But a one-on-one runoff matchup with Paul Vallis, Rahm will become mayoral toast. As crispy as any toast Paul Vallis burnt when he was a kid working in his father's snack shop in Chicago. I'm John Cass, mild-mannered syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune, joined as always by my friend and WGN Radio's Jeff Carlin, producer of the Rokon and Anna DeVellante show. We'll talk politics, we'll talk that steaming mess, still steaming, from Helsinki, and we'll talk about Jeff's weird news of the week. You find us on iTunes, subscribe, there's no paywall for me there, it's all free. And this is the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
So I noticed, Jeff, that when I said on WGN Plus, like trying to be like a real radio guy, that you nodded your head like, oh, yeah, thanks.
Yeah, it's very NPR of you. No, that was good. Was you it hit good? It, man.
NPR, no flutes?
No.
What is with the flutes? That's just my cliched rip on NPR, but is that true?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm assuming somewhere the backstory to that is that somewhere along the line they got the rights to Peruvian flute music, and it worked for them.
So, okay, what's on your mind, Jeff? Because we have Paul Vallis coming in first, but when I'm sitting in the garden, blah, 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 doing the Casso speech, you know.
Sure.
The big speech with the great, you know, is man God? Is God, is man a superhero? And
pondering life.
Yeah, pondering life.
From his tomato garden.
There's no Jeff Carlin right there to smack me upside the head with a stick.
It's free form, John Cass. It's yeah. the jazz of John Cass.
You got to come out there, man.
Oh, I know. Absolutely.
Out. All right? You got to come out there. We got to sit out in the tomato garden. I'll have a cigar, and we'll talk about the news of the day.
Yeah, I'm in.
All right, so what do you got?
I think we need to address the steaming pile of Helsinki.
Okay, let's go.
I mean, you keep teasing it. Mm-hmm. What was your take on it?
For those of you who actually read newspapers, yeah. I already gave my take.
I know, but for those who only carry us in listening form.
You cannot defend it. He equivocated in front of Putin. He deserved to get smacked. And he got smacked. What I find amazing is that the overreaction by the media.
For sure, for
sure. The point where it's now he's a Russian agent, a Putin poodle.
Right. Manchurian candidate was thrown
treason.
Around.
Treason. I'm hearing treason. And you know what? I hear it not only from a psycho bad actor like John Brennan, former CIA, but from everywhere. And here's the thing with that. The more they talk in wild terms,
mm-hmm.
just like after he was elected, they went crazy and started crying. They cried on TV. They cried. You heard it.
Oh, yeah, we saw it.
Oh, my God. You can't do it. Hillary was supposed to win. When you cry and carry on like that, it kind of bleeds into your reporting.
Yeah.
To the point where now when media people are talking about treason.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't want, because he wants to engage with Russia, which we should be doing, other Americans start turning you off. And you go into your bubble, the leftist bubble becomes smaller and smaller, like that little boy. You know the little boy in Twilight Zone?
Mm-hmm.
The one that
had the power?
The one that had the power and if you disagreed with him, he sent you off into the cornfield, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, guess what happens? Pretty soon everyone's going to be in the cornfield except the hard left. And that's not good for the Democratic Party, and it's not good for our country.
No, absolutely.
That's my take.
A great take on it, John.
Thank you, my son.
I was amazed. The overreaction, obviously, we knew that was coming, no matter what happened. I mean, unless if he came out of there and said that Russia has admitted they're giving us these three guys to put in jail for the rest of their lives, you know, if the CNN, all them, they would have found some way to be like, oh, he still dealt with them. You know, it would have been.
He puts on a Superman suit and flies to the Dark Star and destroys it. Yeah.
Right.
Oh, that's terrible.
That would have been best case. But you clearly saw that this president is just so nonchalant about everything, it seems.
He wings it, huh?
Right, he wings it. And you can't wing it against someone like a Vladimir Putin. He's outdanced every U.S. president has sat in his.
Yeah, but was the reaction like this when Barack Obama sainted and praised
his name?
We're building a temple to honor our God here in Chicago. $500 million while kids, you know, can't go to school, but we'll build a temple. Remember when he leaned over and talked to the Russian president and said,
Medved?
Hey. Yeah, Medved. Hey, remember that? On a hot mic.
Be cool.
Be cool and be tell cool. Vlad to be cool.
Be cool to
press that. We'll have Hillary press the reset button. Remember all that?
Oh, yeah. No, that went, but I worked for a conservative station and we tore it apart then too. And we played that tape over and over and over. But my point is just that. You said it. He left a stinking pile of himself in that room. I mean,
he screwed up. It was terrible.
And it just shows that Putin. I mean, it just reinforces how brilliant of a person and a tactician that Putin is. He is so cool under pressure, and
he's a KGB agent.
But I'm reveling in that.
He rides bears without a shirt.
I know. I'm reveling in that. I mean,
bareback,
like 007. He's the real life 007.
His thighs clutching the bear's shoulders.
Yeah, that's too much. Yeah,
I know.
But it's just amazing. Putin, again, he impressed the crap out of me. Like, a scary human being. He clearly is the real life, you know, Dr. Evil. I mean, he's just outthinks everybody. I was blown away, though, that how underprepared it seemed like the president was just to face the public and to think about, oh, I'm going to go do this interview on Fox, do this interview on Fox, and I'm not going to have any of the thought of how this is going to be taken at home. Just on base value, I mean, he lost. The wooden thing, he had to come back 24 hours later. It's just from a communication standpoint, it was a failure across the board for him to not run in anything by anybody and say, oh, well, I'm just going to do this myself.
And then in Aspen, Dan Coats.
Wheaton's Pride.
Wheaton Pride, soccer player. Goalie for the Wheaton.
Yeah, for Wheaton College.
We've interviewed him.
Yeah, they saw it, and they saw it right away. But the delay in him reacting to it, the dumb, he didn't debrief anybody with this after that. I mean, he went right into these interviews with your interviews with Tucker, his interview with
Hannity.
It was a mistake. I watch him for work, but it was a mistake, and it was just such a fumble. I mean, he could have easily made this a strong thing, come out and said, oh, we talked about XYZ, this is what we're going to do. And tap dance their own questions. Vladimir Putin did that.
But here's the thing. Dancing, and yes, I'm not defending it. I'm not defending how he acted. I am defending that we should engage with Russia, okay?
Because for nukes, sure.
And here's the thing. What interests me, if we acknowledge that the Helsinki thing is a steaming mess.
Right.
All right, let's move on to the NATO thing and speak rationally.
Yeah.
And sit upon the ground and talk about the death of kings. Because what you're seeing is anybody who dares to say, do you really want to go to war for Montenegro?
Yeah, over Montenegro.
Over Montenegro. I mean, the expansion of NATO by John McCain, the neocons, and right. all those people who hate Trump mean that young men who are now 14 years old may have to fight in a NATO war for Montenegro because we put NATO, we accepted NATO, Montenegro into NATO. Why the hell did we do that? Why the hell are we expanding NATO? Why are we pushing confrontation with a nuclear power? I don't want to. I mean, I supported Iraq War. They told me there was weapons of mass destruction. We never found any. I don't believe these intelligence. John Brennan, Clapper, I don't care what you say now. I don't believe you guys. Ever. So why do we want to expand NATO? And if I dare say that we shouldn't expand NATO and we should engage the Russians, immediately what? I'm then a Putin toy? I'm Putin's biatch? You know? Is that it? Because I'll take a stick then. You take your stick, I'll take my stick, and we'll see who, you know, walks.
Yeah, I mean, the NATO thing is, it's such an old system. I mean, the idea that it's something that it's from, what, 70 years ago?
Yeah, well, it's from the World War.
Right.
It was to stop the Soviet Union that the New York Times loved and the left loved when they loved
right exactly. I mean it's such an outdated system, and the idea that this is, you know, you have, it should be, there should be an alliance between now after Brexit, US, France, or US and European Union, and part of, you know, Britain and Russia. I mean, there should be a whole group of people to protect. I know it's about money, but the idea that these same, it's the stuff that put us in the problems that we're seeing in Israel. It's the problems we're seeing in states where we drew lines, stuff in Pakistan and India. It's this idea that we, at one point, we thought we knew what we were doing and as being these colonial powers, and we don't. Now we need to back off and let them deal with it themselves.
I don't think we should back out of NATO.
No, NATO should be redrawn.
But I don't think we need to expand it, because every time we expand it, look. Our government under Barack Obama fiddled in Ukraine, right?
Mm-hmm.
We pushed it in Ukraine. We pushed the politics in Ukraine. There was a mini revolution, and Trump grabbed Crimea as a result. Putin grabbed Crimea as a result. Okay, these things have, actions have consequences.
Yeah.
What bothers me is this. The snowflake wailing and screaming on the media, in the media, and I'm part of the media, so are you. Because when we will need them to be honest brokers when crisis hits, and if crisis does hit. And now, 62 million people who voted for Trump are going, hey, I can't believe anything you say. And that's a problem for the republic. No.
Well, and you have the other people who's on the other side who voted for Hillary or who didn't vote for Trump, who say, I can't believe anything you say is facing the White House and in this administration, because there has been a history of lying. So it's a terrible time for this country, just in general, a dangerous time.
I've never seen a politician who didn't lie. I mean, just, you can keep your doctor if you love your doctor. I'm sorry, not love. That was the New York Times. If you like your doctor, you can keep
it. Okay, there's a difference between playing politics and outright just making up facts. I mean, you can say you're going to keep your doctor, and then I'm trying to sell you on an idea, and you can keep your doctor if X, Y, and Z happens. But there's a big difference between
and
outright lying.
I'm going. There's a moral equivalence. And clearly, Trump.
He says stuff
that's not true.
On purpose. Outright lies. So, I mean, that my point is not about who lies when. My point is about, you have half the country, most of the country, voting population at least, doesn't trust the guy in the White House, says that they think everything he does is lying and is untrustworthy.
Back
and
to you the Twilight Zone.
And then you have the same thing on the other side, where you have people who voted for him who believe everything he says, or most of everything he says, and they don't believe the people who say he's lying. And that's the problem this country is facing.
But
and,
how does that happen? It happens when the media goes over the top with their nonsense to the point where people don't believe them anymore. I challenge everybody who's listening to this. Find your favorite news source. Google that with these following words, Trump and Hitler. I mean, there was a time when you called you dropped the Hitler card, the conversation was over. You're not a serious person. You're a doofus.
Right.
You know, now the Hitler card, the treason card, it's the ratcheting of this up. Their circle is getting smaller, not larger.
You're overlooking the biggest elephant in the room for what's modeling the way people see and believe things and believe facts. And that's the social media. That's the peer-to-peer, unfettered exchange of quote-unquote information.
That's part of it. Overlooking it.
Well, but you're saying media. That doesn't really count as media. Well, that's not people. I'm talking the thing that has driven people so far into these echo chambers is social media. The fact that it's peer-to-peer, there's no editorial focus there, and information spreads like viruses when it's wrong and viruses when it's true, but it's dangerous. That's the part that I think is bigger.
Crosstalk in broadcast is when people like me and you were
right.
But in social media world, if you can't say one thing nice about a conservative without being trashed.
Yeah, but that's always been true about anybody who has anonymity. Anonymity is driving that, though. People don't care. There's no civility, so they can say whatever they want online. And social media is changing the way people communicate. We're not being more inclusive in communication. We're being less inclusive. We're huddling our wagons around each other. And the tribalization and social media, that is playing a way bigger role than anything is doing on CNN or Fox or NBC. Because that stuff is only, you look at the Twitter circling of that stuff. So the people that I forgot which group did it, but there's a study of Twitter users and how they connect to each other, like who follows who and who's following what. And if you look at the people who voted for Trump, a skew of that, none of them follow NBC, ABC, NBC, CBS. They don't follow any of those things on Twitter. They don't interact with them. They only interact with the people who voted for Trump, or people who were supporters of Trump, or people who were, you know, in PACs that were supportive of Trump. So their circle is very tiny. So the media, they can lie.
I would assume that the converse is also true.
Absolutely.
I was listening to a podcast by Ben Shapiro. You know who he is?
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about some actor, I don't know the actor, who said something like, I met Ben Shapiro, he seems like a nice guy, and I learned some interesting things, even though we don't agree politically.
Yeah.
He said that on Twitter. Immediately, he was flamed, or whatever they call that, where all your friends hate you, everybody hates you, they go back in time, they call you a racist and a scumbag. And then he comes back and he says he's sorry. He deletes his tweet and he apologizes for having having a discussion between left and right.
Mm-hmm. But that's a symptom of social media and going back to, you know, MySpace and before that, even AOL and chat rooming. I mean, you've had this has been building since the late 80s, that you've had that society stripping itself apart because we're separating
on ideals. I'm not arguing with you or denying that.
I think you're overplaying the role of the media in it.
I don't think so.
In what we're seeing now is symptomatic of what was happened before.
That's probably part of it, but I see what we used to call the mainstream media or the, mm-hmm. you know, newspapers, the kind of discussion that's being allowed was only allowed in the past on the fringes. Now they're openly talking about the president of the United States as, you know, he could be Putin's boy, openly.
Well,
I mean, you're actually saying that the Russian government is controlling us.
So
I mean, are you serious?
You're saying based on the Helsinki thing and the way acted standing next to Putin, that there's no way that there's any sphere or universe of possibility that they have information or they have some sort of relation to Trump, and there's an influence there.
You're falling into the trap.
It's not a trap. I see everything. I don't listen to anybody else. I look at the facts. I look at what he says. I look at what Putin says, and I look what happens. Take anyone. No one's telling me.
You
watched him there, and you didn't see somebody who was kneeling at the man next to him.
I didn't see him kneeling. What I saw was. And it's interesting that we could see the same thing and see.
Right, I know. Absolutely. That's what Wes Putin would say, check your eyes.
Yeah, after he plucks them out.
Right.
But I would say that what happened there was a man who he knows that, and I did say it. I wrote it in a column. In the column that I condemned him, that he knows that the argument of much of the media and the left is that he's not my president. He's not legitimate. He's not a legitimate president. He's the tool of Putin. And so his wounded ego won't allow him to answer these questions in that way. I think that's small of him, and I think that's wrong of him. What happens as a result, Putin is the one taking advantage of it through this kind of criticism. I mean, if you look at MSNBC, these people, I mean, it's like I don't listen to InfoWars.
Right.
The closest I ever got to InfoWars was watching Homeland and seeing a characterization of the InfoWars people on Homeland. And in this, I see the InfoWars people and sharing the same psychic space with MSNBC and the three networks. They've just lost their minds. They're gone.
And it's a crazy times, but I still think that the influence of someone like an MSNBC or even an NBC or an ABC, it's if you look at broadcast television, their share of the population in this country has been on a steady decline. It's dwindling, dwindling, dwindling. There were people who are getting information and sharing ideas across other platforms.
From who?
That's my point. Is that that NBC, ABC, CBS, more than we're saying a percentage more, they get facts straight as they are than the rest of the internet and social media where people are getting information. And that's the danger. That's the thing. That's where the red alarm should be going off. People don't know what facts are anymore. And it is to your point that the media has leading
because they want clicks.
Right.
So anytime you say, if you write a headline for a news site, Trump sucks. He's Putin's baby, or some word that I would say. That will get you clicks.
Right.
And so as the narrow casting in print and in broadcast continues, people are searching for eyeballs on their – and the way to get the eyeballs is to appeal to the tribalism.
Yep. And that's why the Clapper said, I believe, the red alarms are blinking, but it's not just because – Trump may or may not have interest in Russia. It's because our society is tearing itself apart.
Yes, and isn't it odd that when the establishment is threatened, then the society is tearing itself apart? It's interesting. So Trump was elected to kick them in the crotch. He did. And now the society is being torn apart.
No, not now. No.
They're the ones.
It's been
I don't like
well,
Trump.
Well before Trump was the – he capitalized on society's – crumbling echoization of itself. I mean that he's not the. This isn't. He didn't cause this. This has been going on. This has been building to this point. He's a speck on what the history of our country and the history of our society. He's a symptom of things that have been happening.
He's a symptom of something larger. But let's be clear: if the establishment weren't threatened by him, they wouldn't be shrieking as loudly and putting our nation at risk. I think a lot of this. Clapper, I mean, don't trust. Look, the guy was asked directly several times, are you surveilling the American people? He said, no, of course not.
Right.
And it turned out that he was. He's going through your cell phone. Anytime you lie to me twice, you lie to me once, you know, I'm not. And then you ask me to go to Chinatown for spaghetti dinner at 11:30. I'm not coming.
There it is, the Chicago way.
What we've got here is failure to communicate. Communication breakdown. It's always the same. Having a breakdown.
and joining us to talk about the man in the soft fuzzy sweater, the man who's feeling sad now because people are yelling at him, the man who was, I think he was speaking in a soft, tiny voice, asking people on the South Side not to yell and protest. That's Rahm Emanuel. The one guy he doesn't want to face is Paul Vallis. Hey, Paul.
Well, thanks for having me.
Welcome.
I have no sweater.
You have no fuzzy sweater?
Got rid of my sweaters long. Never had a soft, fuzzy sweater.
You didn't?
No.
If you're elected mayor and then you do a lot of things that people don't like, will you hope to have a venue where you can show up at the Economic Club and talk? I mean, I read some stuff in Rahm's paper. I was amazed.
Well, yeah. Well, look, you know, as someone who raised money to finance over 125 funerals when I was in the Chicago Public Schools and attended each of those funerals and just didn't do cameos because, you know, when you go to those, my approach was to go to the funerals and to stay from the beginning to the end and not get up there and speak or walk out of the building with my hand on the casket and things like that. My approach was always to sit in the back. The importance was to remember, but without the grandstanding. I don't know. I mean, you know, this is the same guy who won't give the paramedics their five ambulances that have been sitting mothballed for the last 4 to 5 years, or for that matter, took their bunker gear away, which is of course the fire retardant and the breathing apparatus devices, and try to take. I think you did a story on it.
The vests.
Try to take the vests away, or at least, you know, indirectly through the fire department, because probably because they supported Chuy Garcia and raised $10,000 for him. So I'm just not sympathetic.
Jeff Carlin, what do you think of where the mayoral race is? My belief is Rahm wants to campaign at 30,000 feet, fly in for, you know, fly low and get a hug from, you know, his newspaper, and then fly, you know, the tabloid.
And go fly back to China and so then, you can...
Yeah, or fly to China or whatever, fly back down to get a hug from Melody Hobson, fly up again, you know, but be up here.
Right. Away.
He doesn't want to be down here, down on the street level. What do you make of it? What do you think?
No, I think he's scared. I mean, I think he's, unlike last time around, which I think he kind of just took it for granted that he was going to win and didn't put in quite the same effort, he's working harder earlier. And especially with his latest, you know, soft words and fuzzy feelings, he's got a lot of people he's trying to make see him in a different light that he didn't see him, especially with Laquan McDonald on the horizon.
Can he do that again, Paul? He's trying to do the soft fuzzy sweater again.
I don't think so. Every poll I've seen, 2/3 of the populace are really strong on their desire to see another mayoral candidate. I mean, Willie Wilson came out with a poll the other day that showed him within light. 8 percentage points in like about more than half the populace the registered voters who were polled were undecided. Look, I mean, it's clear the strategy. The strategy is to, and I used to be in the budget office where they would drag us down to those morning meetings and there would be the poster, and there would be the political consultant. They'd talk about, well, what's going to be the message of the week or the message of the day? The whole idea, this is the D.C. model. Let's do the spin. Let's try to capture the news for the day. Let's try to put something out when we know a negative story is happening so that we can divert attention.
Control that story. You know, don't let it control you.
Last week, suddenly the schools are flush with cash. We're going to do $1 billion in school construction. We're not going to tell you how we're going to do it. We are going to put another high school on the west side. But, of course, they're not telling us whether or not they're going to close Wells. And then just the other day, $2 billion. Suddenly they're going to find $2 billion so that they can make all the CTA platforms accessible. And look, as someone who made all the public schools accessible, you know, I believe facilities should be accessible. But suddenly, $2 billion. Meanwhile, they're still digging up about 400, they're still digging up pipes all over the city, the water main pipes all over the city, which are, in effect, loosening lead pollutants into the connecting lines between the homes and those main pipes. They still haven't released the data about the level of lead contamination, and they're kind of telling us, well, we can't afford the $1 billion or so that it's going to take to finance the replacement of the lead-piped connecting lines. And remember, we allowed lead pipe, or they mandated lead pipe connecting lines up until 1986 for obvious reasons. So we've got all these pollutants in the water that children drink, that children are ingesting, and they're doing nothing about it because they're basically saying it's up to the homeowners. It's up to the overtaxed homeowners to pay the $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $10,000 in costs on what it would take to get rid of those lead contaminated pipes and replace them with. But we have $1 billion suddenly for schools. Didn't he just close 50 or 60 schools? And we got $2 billion for the CTA, not for the red line or the blue line. Because don't worry, Musk is going to take care of that. We're going to have the underground. Let's call it the Underground Railroad to O'Hare Airport.
Or the underground, we get in tubes, right?
And right. Shoot us the tubes. So
anyone believe this guy?
It's all a diversion. It's all a diversion. Oh, and I didn't even mention universal early childhood education for four-year-olds. But we're going to get how are we going to fund that? $175 million from the state. Well, suddenly the state is just going to provide us with an overflow of funding for every initiative that's out there. So every week we're going to get an initiative. Every other day we're going to get an initiative.
Here's the question on this. He does come up, for both of you, he does come up with these plans that deal with his politics. Like, you don't think I care about children? Well, here's $1 billion for this. You don't think I care about kids? Here's $1 billion for that, or two. I care about the the disabled. All the platforms, everything's done. He never says where the money's coming from, or he can't really explain it, right?
And the question is, he never does it. I mean, people should go back and they should look at what he promised in his first campaign and what he promised in his second campaign. Some of these are recycled promises. I mean, the bottom line, and how does this fit into any long-term or comprehensive strategic plan? I'm preparing a chart, and I'm going to release the chart as soon as I finalize it. And it's going to look at all his promises. It's going to chart the promises.
Oh, good.
And it's going to put a list together of all the things that have been promised in the last 12 to 18 months. It's unbelievable. I mean, suddenly we're concerned about development on the west side and the south side. And I didn't want and I want to get into that in a second. But suddenly we're concerned about development on the west side and the south side. It took them till 2016 to do the developer's fee. And how's that money being allocated? Do we have an inventory? Suddenly people are getting –
what is the developer's fee, Paul?
There's a developer's fee. People,
they have to come up with money.
They have to come up with money when they do these big major developments. And right. What they're doing is they're levying a fee. It's almost like link investments here. They make an investment, but that investment has to be linked with a contribution that they're going to make to the city that the city can then use to allocate to other underdeveloped areas. But where's the strategy behind that local development? First of all, they wait till 2016 to do it, just like they waited till 2017 to go to the legislature to get pension funding for the Chicago Teachers Retirement System, which incidentally will leave Chicago property taxpayers on the hook because of their delay. To about the tune of about $1.5 billion, but they come up with this developer's fee, but yet that developer's fee can be allocated without any sort of city council oversight. You got 50 aldermen, and there's going to be no oversight for these developer fees. That means City Hall can award a grant up to $250,000 without city council approval. So
to who?
It's become another
some community group that might be supportive of a certain mayor.
Well, hopefully during the course of this campaign. The investigatory reporters will go in and they'll dig this out, or they'll file their FOIs and they'll get the information that they need. But the point is, between the TIF kitty and the developer fee kitty, I mean, all they're doing is you're going to see them handing out money left and right to try to make up for lost time. The bottom line, though, is they waited. They waited 7 years. They waited 7 years. To at least create a mechanism by which the west sides and the south sides could benefit, could share in the largesse from the profits that are being reaped by these developers for these, large major developments. 7 years. What was going on during that period of time?
Violence the city has been plagued in.
So we're going to get, they're going to try to do, I think they're going to, I suspect that they're going to try to improve his numbers by kind of running this Rose Garden campaign and make an announcement every so often. Or go to China. Do you think for a second that the Chinese were going to cancel? Please, I mean, how stupid do you think we are? Do you think for a second that the Chinese were going to cancel a contract that was going to pay their companies $1.3 billion because they were pissed off at Trump? Please spare me. And then, of course, who was on the trip? who's who in campaign contributors? And then, of course, I think they recycled two or three announcements that they had made, like the so-called agreement with Japan, unique agreement with Japan.
Right.
And, oh, my God.
Mayor Globetrotter, Paul. I wrote a column on it.
Oh my God.
Globetrotter.
If I hear one more time about this guy, they were trying to they claimed that he got to meet with this assistant finance guy, and they kept on saying that they were so surprised that they were able to meet with him because he's a real mover and shaker. He was someone's assistant, for crying out loud. I mean, it's not like he met with the minister of finance.
So it was like some minister said, go out, get me some coffee, and while you're there, you might see some
guy. Yeah, go see that guy from Chicago. See what he wants.
The tiny dancer out
there. Hey, listen, $1.3 billion. For what? $1.3 billion, and they're going to create 200 temporary jobs on the South Side? Come on, people. I mean, really. So it's all about spinning. It's all about, and there were at least three stories on the trip.
There's the only one I cared about was the one from Bill Ruthart, who broke it down.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Who were the insiders.
Oh, my God.
But
in a very objective way, non-editorial way.
Yeah.
This is who went. This is their connection.
And what they wouldn't say and who paid what. And
that's
who gave.
Right. And Bill's methodical when it comes to those type
but
of things.
I didn't see the others. Were the other ones glowing? Because I don't read the mayor's paper anymore. I just don't. I probably should. You think I should get a subscription?
Well, I just think, I just don't think it's going to work. And whether you vote for me or one of the other qualified and capable candidates in the race, I mean, enough is enough. Look, I will tell you, I've never been more frustrated by what he's done to the police department. I don't even want to get into schools. They have created – I did a forum yesterday. It was a candidates forum with the independent voters. And,
most of the candidates were there except for –
Except Rahm. Rahm wasn't there.
And you said the quote that came out from the story I saw was, I'm a crisis manager. That's what I do.
But let me tell you, I have to tell you this. They asked us questions, and then one by one we responded to the questions. They asked questions about the police department. And look, there's no stronger person when it comes to accountability than me. I certainly demonstrated in the schools. And indeed, there are people out there who don't like me who think I went overboard on the accountability side, so I'm not one who does not believe in strong accountability. And I feel when people break the law, don't follow the rules, they need to be punished. And if you have bad police officers, they need to be removed expeditiously. But this is the point, everybody got up and made a comment about the police department. And I'm not going to characterize their comments because I'm not running against them. I'm running against Rahm. I got up and I spoke to the group and I said, when I was in Chicago Public Schools, I paid for more funerals than I don't even remember what the exact number was. And I went to those funerals. We created the crisis line.
Yeah, I remember you going.
And not one of those kids who were killed in their community were shot by a police officer. The point that I was making was when I go into these communities, maybe the issue of the police treatment of people in those communities are sixth on the list or seventh on the list. People are telling me in the communities on the west side and the south side, there's not enough police officers. Our public safety needs are not being addressed. There's lead in the water. The fees and fines are killing us. We still have that vacant school building down the street that's rotting and that's decaying. That's what they talk about, and that's what they talk about consistently. We'll be right back.
One of the, we had Kristen McQuarrie, our friend Kristen, was on the one of the last podcasts, not the last one, the one before, and she had an interesting comment about you. She said, you know, you're going to be vetted, but you have a tendency to be scattered when you talk in debate. I maybe I'm too close to it because I think you're the best and only candidate who could beat Rahm Emanuel in a runoff. And I think he wants to pick others to, he'd like to go up against Dorothy Brown or some nonsensical candidate. But is there merit to the criticism of your public persona?
Yeah, you know, probably I am professorial type, and, you know, my comments don't lend themselves to basically 1 minute or 30-second or 15-second sound bites. But let me tell you what I try to do. And I invite people to go to my website, because when I made my public safety announcement, I tried to focus on the key issues, but then I posted everything on my announcement. What I do with schools, the CTA, how I do it and how I pay for it. And
what is that website?
And my hope is
it, what's the website?
It's valisforallchicago.com.
Okay.
But what I hope to do is to be able to have that 60-second or 30-second soundbite, but then to lead people to the more detailed explanation. You know, because everybody's doing listening campaigns, somebody needs to do an answering campaign. And, you know, I mean, what's the community going to tell us? What they've been telling us for the last 7-8 years, for the last 10 years, for the last 20 years, they want safe neighborhoods, they want good schools, they want clean water, they want their infrastructure to be improved, they want economic opportunities. I mean, that's what they're going to tell us time and time again.
They don't want their kids shot off the porch.
Right. You know, they want answers. They want answers to complicated questions. But, you know, I want to talk about police because I think he's really messed up the police department in so many ways. The point that I've made over and over again is, you know, you can strengthen the police department and bring accountability simultaneously, because when you allow, through attrition, the number of police officers to be significantly reduced, and they all play the attrition game, daily play the attrition game. You know, I ended the attrition game when I was city budget director. And when in the process of not filling 1,500 to 2,000 positions, you also allow your detectives division to be decimated, where they go from 1,200 to like less than 700.
And that's what I couldn't
think about that for a second. It's think about that meant at one point only 3% of our police officers were detectives. In New York, 15% of the police officers are detectives. Maybe that's why they had a 90% reduction in their murder rate since the peak in the 1990s. But when you do that, what does that do? When you go from one sergeant for every 10 officers to 30 sergeants for every 10 officers, when you don't set standards for the selection of training officers or incentivize them to become training officers, so training officers become volunteers, not the best and the brightest. I have two boys who are police officers in other districts. They're training. They still have access to their training officers. They were the most experienced cops and accomplished on the force. When you do that, what happens is you sap the police department of its strength, and you basically destroy the type of supervisory infrastructure that brings about real accountability. I mean, you need to have enough police officers on the street so that you can guarantee that there is beat integrity. You know, the tragedy of that young person, that person who was shot.
South Shore?
South Shore.
Harith Augustus, the barber.
I'm not making a value judgment. The tapes will speak. He had a gun. You know, question whether or not he was making a fervent move.
I think he reached.
And I'm not saying things could have been different. But when you don't have beat integrity, when you're moving police all over the city because beats are understaffed, or because you want to put out this political fire, that political fire, you get heat on Lakeshore Drive, you get heat on Michigan Avenue, suddenly you're deploying cops. I mean, do you realize that they during the 4th of July weekend, they had 1,000 cops, extra cops, paying them overtime to stand around and to establish a presence.
Scarecrows.
And the police officers, that's their terminology, that's not my terminology. Yes. And then during the 4th of July, 1,500 officers 13 days, all leaves were canceled. No time off. Think of police officers working 13 consecutive days, and whether they're getting overtime or not overtime, the bottom line, 13 consecutive days, not 8-hour days, but many officers working 12 hours a day. Think how exhausting that can be. Think how exhausting that can be. But when you're moving people all over the city like that, and you don't have that beat integrity, let me tell you what happens in that community. First of all, you have police officers in that community who don't know people in the community. Maybe somebody, so somebody's walking down the street and you know it's the age of carrying concealed and, right. You know, the NRA wants everybody to have a firearm. Well, you don't know if someone's packing or not packing. But if you know who that person is and you know they're not a gangbanger and you know they work at the local barbershop or some other store down the street, and maybe you approach them differently. And more importantly, if they know you, maybe they're less inclined to react or to panic. And I'm not making value judgments on this particular incident, but it's that familiarity. It's that rapport that develops. It's that, you know, having police in that district properly supervised with the resources, with the alternative, with the alternatives to the use of lethal force.
With the training
and the repeat training. You're in the Army. Every year, you have to be trained on your primary tasks. Every year. When I was a company commander, then they would come in and evaluate me. The first thing they would look at was my training schedule. So every year you've got to qualify. Every year, whether it's nuclear, chemical, biological warfare, whether it's, you know, how to use your gas mask, you know, your CPR, or for that matter, qualify on the rifle range and things like that. Every year it's redundant training. You know, when my son was in combat in Afghanistan, he said, "Dad, what saved us, because a war battle is organized, is yes, confusion, is those standard operating procedures. We're taught how to respond. We draw comfort in the fact that there is a leadership there, because, you know, in the military, it's one squad leader for every 10 soldiers, just like it should be one sergeant for every 10 police that are on that beat." And at one point, they had allowed that to be 1 to 30. Think about the lack of supervision there. But the point is, it's that training. It's that training that you fall back on. It's that constant and consistent training. And that is what has been lacking, because everything about the management of the police department, and I'm not talking about Eddie Johnson. I have no quarrel with Eddie Johnson. Eddie Johnson's a fine cop. It's City Hall micromanaging them.
The boss is Rahm Emanuel. Paid the cop to be the boss. Question, we're going to have more candidates coming in the race. I see Rahm would want maybe 30 African-American candidates, and now he's going to get more white candidates. Bridget Gaynor will be in. How does that affect your ability to get your message out when she'll be, at least for a time, the media flavor of the month, the new candidate coming in? She'll probably even show up on the podcast here. I might even take her to lunch at Manny's.
You've never taken me to lunch at Manny's. But, you know, it doesn't make any difference. I can't worry about who else is entering the race. I know Bridget. I like Bridget. And I was very close to Bridget's father, who was an absolute great guy. The whole family, it's a great family. And she's an accomplished public servant. So I can't worry about that. You know, I'll tell you, when you do have a lot of candidates, you have a debate like we had yesterday where you got 60 seconds to talk about your vision for the city and you got like 60 seconds to respond to complicated questions. That may not lend itself to the way I approach things. And it also allows people's individual messages to become diluted. So it may adversely impact the candidates individually. But the bottom line is, the interesting thing with all those candidates, and there's no collusion going on. I don't question the motivations of any of those candidates, and you know, because I think they're motivated. I know some better than I know others, and at the end of the day, we're all motivated and united by our desire to ensure that the city is offered a viable alternative to the present mayor, who I think has been an absolute disaster.
He's got $10 million, Jeff Garland, at least.
Oh yeah.
Doesn't include all the money from China that'll be coming off that trip. What is he going to do with that money?
He's going to buy, well, he's going to probably add some ad time in the Sun-Times, I'd imagine.
A discount rate there.
Discount rate. And you're going to see probably another warm sweater video somewhere, one of those ads where he's hugging a walrus or something, endangered animal sitting next to him, I'm imagining. And it's going to be a greater Chicago through softer leadership.
Look, I want to say this. I would ask the Economics Club to invite the other candidates to a forum. I'd like, someone to sit down and interview or grill me for an hour. You know what I mean? Why not? So they can get different perspectives on this. So at the end of the day, we're going to be reliant on people like you and others to allow us to get the word out because, let's face it, they're going to try to dominate the news. And the problem is...
Well, they could, you don't rely on me. The point is...
Well, when I'm talking about going, you and people like you...
He's going to be...
Give us a forum.
He's going to be trying to drop a new story every day,
right.
New chaos every day that he can spin away from. He was chased out of a coffee with Pritzker on 43rd Street the other day. One of the Black Lives Matter people were chasing him, and he just ran out.
Yeah.
Ran out to the Economic Club to get a nice hug.
I had a friend of mine. He lives in Lincoln Park, and he's been circulating petitions on. And this was in an area where Rahm was a stronghold last time. Petitions on term limits, and he said 90% of the people signed. It's just, it's like he just thinks that people have about had it and they want change.
But how are you able to? One of the reasons I think that why your candidacy is interesting to me, among many, but one reason is that ultimately this is going to be about who could run the city. They're fine candidates. They can talk. They have good ideas or some bad ideas, but personalities, and they have strong personalities and weak. But the bottom line is that who could run the city? And in political terms, the mayor has these corporate bosses and all the big shot money guys dropping him cash. He's got $10 million. But when do they realize that, hey, he's shaky, and we better, have a plan B?
Well, I think they'll wait until the runoff for a plan B, quite frankly. I just believe that that's what's going to happen. And there are a lot of fence sitters, and I encounter people all the time who would like to support me, but it's the same thing. I never met more accomplished people who are afraid of Rahm Emanuel. People on the street aren't afraid of Rahm Emanuel. Working families are afraid of Rahm Emanuel. Those military vets in the Rolls and Pullman area, the NAB vets, the National Association of Black American Veterans, who are going to support me and support me strongly, Commander Davis, they're not afraid of Rahm Emanuel. really.
So who's afraid of him then?
Yeah, so I think a lot of the people who do business with the city, who want to do business with the city, who have done business with the city, who are comfortable in making money while a good part of the city continues to deteriorate. I just don't think that, they may realize that he's he brings the D.C. management, the Washington, D.C. management skills to Chicago, which means they don't know how to manage government to save their lives. I just think that these are people who do not want to hedge their bets. So I submit to you that they're going to sit on the sidelines. They'll either support him or hold back their money and sit on the sidelines until the November runoff. And then it'll be a different game if someone like me or a comparable candidate who they believe has the skills to run the city ends up in the runoff, I think.
If you're in a runoff,
I think that person will get more financial support than perhaps Chewy got the last time.
I would say it would be a good bet. If you're in the runoff with him, I don't think you'll have any trouble getting money.
No,
if others are in the runoff with him,
you got to get into the runoff, though.
Yeah.
But look,
and that's the game.
Yeah, yeah, and I just need to outwork him, and I need to get my message out, which I will. And sometimes what that means is taking advantage of opportunities to be in the community, to talk to people, to do everyone's podcast again and again. And it also means, you know, look, on Sunday, you know, we're going to have an announcement on public safety. Next week, we're going to talk about affordable housing. In 4 weeks, I'm going to lay out my long-term financial plan for the city about the time that he begins his budget hearings. So I'm going to tell people how we're going to get out of this financial mess and invest in the type of things like safe neighborhoods and quality schools and get, you know, infrastructure investments so that, you know, we're getting lead out of the drinking water and out of our homes, and what we're going to do to create economic opportunities. So I'm going to do that, and hopefully I'll be able to draw the attention I need to demonstrate to people that I have what it takes to run the city.
As long as you don't wear that soft, fuzzy sweater, and I don't think you have one, and I think your family would just, your boys would, like, jump on you and give you a crack. If
well, they are complaining about my wardrobe.
Oh, they're there?
Oh, yeah, I've got more offers to take me shopping.
Don't worry about that. It's what's in the head that counts. For Jeff Carlin, WGN radio producer of the Rokan Show with Anna Devalanis, and for me, John Cass, your humble, nationally syndicated columnist at the Chicago Tribune.
Also for Paul Vallis, thanks for coming in.
This thanks is, for having me.
Oh, our pleasure. You are the crisis manager the city in crisis probably needs.
There you go.
For myself as well. On the Chicago Way, we'll talk to you next week.
Excellent.